I'm Jennifer Westaway. Robin Young is off today.
I'm Alan Cockle.
It's Here and Now.
John Kerry has named his vice presidential running mate. It is North Carolina Senator John Edwards. Kerry made the announcement this morning at a political rally in Pittsburgh.
John Edwards is ready for this job. He is ready for this job, and there is something else about John Edwards that is important in this campaign and our country at this critical time. As you know, I am determined that we reach out across party lines, that we speak the heart of America, that we speak of hope and of optimism, and John Edwards will join me in doing that.
John Edwards was born in South Carolina and raised in North Carolina. The son of a mill worker, he himself is a trial lawyer who earned a fortune from medical malpractice and product liability cases. The one-term senator is a centrist Democrat, a strong campaigner with a populist message. He was also Kerry's one-time rival for the Democratic nomination. So what does John Edwards bring to the Kerry campaign, and how will he play in the few swing states on which the presidential election is likely to turn? To discuss, we're joined by David Yepsen, political columnist at the Des Moines Register in Iowa, and by Adam Smith, political editor at the St. Petersburg Times in Florida. Gentlemen, hello to you both.
Good to be with you.
Hi.
This was a closely held secret. Adam, were you surprised?
You know, I was, like everybody else, I was working the phones all weekend long, and it seemed like every hour people were suggesting somebody else had the edge and somebody else was down. So a little surprised, not especially.
And David Yepsen?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it was clear Edwards was in the hunt. It was a closely guarded secret, but so in that sense, we're all a little bit surprised, but we're not, because it was clear Edwards was in the mix.
David Yepsen, does it strike you as unusual that John Edwards was at home in Washington this morning when Kerry made his announcement in Pittsburgh?
No, I think Kerry wanted to keep the lid on this, and he gets a little bump out of this story today, and he'll get another bump out of it when Edwards joins him on the ticket for the big picture, the hands in the air kind of picture.
Right. Well, let's go to the swing states. You're both in swing states. Adam Smith in Florida. What does Edwards bring, and does he as a Southerner have any special resonance with Florida voters?
Yeah, I think he should. Florida is has some very distinct regions, and particularly North Florida is more or less the true South, where you have a lot of, it's really a Republican stronghold and more conservative voters. And I think unlike Kerry, Edwards clearly should be able to campaign pretty effectively there.
And David, in Iowa, Kerry passed over another potential VP, Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, in favor of Edwards. How will Iowa voters react to the choice?
I think it'll be a plus for John Kerry. I don't think many Iowans thought Governor Tom Vilsack was really in the hunt here. I think, too, that a lot of Democrats are so angry at the Bush administration that any hurt they may have over the fact that their own hometown guy got passed over is really trumped by their dislike of Bush.
Mm. Adam, there probably isn't a Democrat anymore who can deliver a whole region the way Lyndon Johnson did for Kennedy in 1960. But do you think Edwards even brings his own state of North Carolina?
Well, I think it looks like he's at least puts it somewhat in play. There was the Raleigh News and Observer had a poll a few weeks ago where I think, to the surprise of a lot of people, Bush was leading by about 5 points. So at the very least, if that's a valid poll, Edwards is going to force the Bush-Cheney campaign to spend some resources in North Carolina.
David, more generally, what does Edwards bring to a Kerry campaign?
I think he balances out the ticket culturally a little bit. Democrats never win the White House unless they have a Southerner somewhere on their ticket. That's been true all throughout modern American political history, and I think it's especially true now. John Kerry is the Easterner. The rap on him is he's a little bit aloof, too visceral, and John Edwards is more grassroots and can relate to people, as you say, regionally, not just state by state, but working class people, people who like positive campaigns. He understands the plight of middle America and lower income Americans, and I think he will have an appeal to them, particularly in those border states of North Carolina, Missouri, Arkansas, Tennessee, and Kentucky. I think particularly in those areas, having somebody who speaks with an accent will be useful.
Let me read you a quote. This is John Kerry in January speaking about John Edwards. He says, "In the Senate 4 years, and that's the full extent of public life, no international experience, no military experience. When I came back from Vietnam in 1969, I don't know if John Edwards was out of diapers." Adam?
Well, I think we're going to be seeing that and some other quotes quite a bit, including Kerry suggesting at one time that that Edwards couldn't carry his home state. But that's to be expected. And if memory serves, I don't recall Edwards ran such a positive campaign in the primary. There weren't a whole lot of sharp elbows that he threw at Kerry. There were a few in later weeks, but that's to be expected, and we're going to be hearing a lot of that.
David, doesn't the VP normally go or often go negative?
Yes.
Can Edwards do that?
Well, he can do that, and I think he'll be on the attack. He gives a good fiery stump speech, but he puts a smile on it. And so I think while he's known as a positive campaigner, I think he can also be a good spear chucker. And as, in terms of these the spats that they had and the rivalries and these things, the Republicans will now be dredging up. That's politics. I mean, this is business. And the Democrats now want to try to find 270 electoral votes. John Kerry has figured John Edwards is going to help him do that more than anybody else. And the old quotes, I don't think they're going to resonate that much with people. I mean, it didn't bother Ronald Reagan when he picked the first President Bush to be his running mate. We're still hearing about Bush's comments about voodoo economics. So that's to be expected in politics, and I think most voters discount it.
Well, Edwards is that Republican bête noir, a trial lawyer. Does that make him vulnerable to Republican attacks, do you think?
Yes, and Republicans always have a problem with trial lawyers. It hasn't seemed to slow him down. He's a very articulate man, and I think the fact that he has that experience working a jury, arguing a case. I mean, if you watch him on the stump, many times he's not working a crowd, he's working a jury. He's a very articulate guy, and Republicans have good reason to fear John Edwards at this point.
The other thing is I spent some time in North Carolina looking at perceptions of Edwards in his home state, and yes, he was a trial lawyer, but he was a very elite trial lawyer. He wasn't pumping out hundreds of cases. He was picking cases where the person he was representing was tended to be a very sympathetic person. So at least in North Carolina, people in his first race tried to throw the trial lawyer question at him, and a lot of voters said felt like Edwards was the one sticking up for the people that they were rooting for.
Gentlemen, thank you to you both.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Adam Smith is the political editor of the St. Petersburg Times in Florida. David Yepsen is political columnist at the Des Moines Register in Iowa.
Did the CIA give President Bush the whole story about Iraq's weapons program? No, says the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. The New York Times says that a committee report due this week will condemn the agency for not sharing all that it knew with the White House before the war. Melissa Maley is a consultant on security and political issues in the Middle East. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Melissa, what sort of information did the CIA not tell the president?
Well, this is quite the controversy now that the CIA had information that went against its assumptions that Saddam was indeed actively procuring weapons of mass destruction and that they didn't factor that information sufficiently into their assessments.
Where did the information come from?
Defectors from family relatives, I should say, of people who lived inside Iraq, and then this latest information from scientists.
And relatives of those Iraqi scientists as well.
Yes.
And I understand that they were saying that the unconventional weapons program had actually stopped.
That's exactly what they were saying, and that is the same message that they had been receiving through other sources, but it did not jibe with their assumptions, and therefore it was dismissed.
Well, how could that happen?
I think one of the things that when an intelligence analyst takes a look at information, they look at the reliability factor and who are these people? How do they know the information? Do they have an agenda that might be separate to influence and inform Washington policymakers,
mm-hmm.
and they factor all those things together to come up with an assessment of reliability. And if they're hearing something that doesn't jive with what they think they should be hearing, they might downgrade that reliability for one reason or another.
The CIA has said that it assumed that all these denials were part of an Iraqi agenda to deceive the international community.
Very much so. They believe that the Iraqi government had this very elaborate denial and deception operation going. And so, and believing that, therefore, anything that they heard that said, oh, no, we don't have it, oh, no, we stopped our program, that was had to be part of the denial and deception program and not the truth.
Well, can we take an example of one of the things where information went awry? And I'm thinking about the shipment of aluminum tubes that the U.S. seized. It was on its way to Iraq. Tell us what happened there.
When they obtained the tubes and they examined them, the assumption was, because they were being sent clandestinely, that they had to be used for something that was not above board. And therefore, they started saying, this has to be part of the weapons of mass destruction. That was the assumption, as opposed to being a conventional weapon. And so the CIA analysts made there, the technical folks came up with an analysis that, hey, this is used for, this is part of a centrifuge, for gas centrifuge program.
A
nuclear program,
right.
Exactly. But that was not, you know, within the intelligence community, there was not a consensus on this. It was quite controversial.
Did they report that this was further evidence of a nuclear program?
Yes, and this was one of those key issues that came up in the national intelligence estimate that was done in the run-up to the war, and it was part of that, one of those key factors that proved, hey, there's an active nuclear weapons program going on, and see, here's the proof. Here are these tubes for the gas centrifuges. So, you know, we've caught them red-handed in this program.
Do we presume that the CIA had some sort of a political agenda? Was it being influenced by the White House? Was it simple incompetence? How do we view it?
I think that what we view here is a critical problem within the analytical tradecraft, or in other words, the skills that the analysts use within the intelligence community. And it's not a new problem. It's been going on for a very long time, and that is that they work on the basis of these assumptions. And if you don't have a good enough program built into it to question assumptions, you're going to come out with these really wrong assessments.
Melissa, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Melissa Maley is a consultant on security and political issues in the Middle East. She joined us from Washington, D.C.
Just ahead, the story of the Pullman porters, former slaves hired to work the rails.
And later in the show, psychotropic drugs in the classroom. What rights do parents have?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
I'm Alan Cockle.
It's Here and Now.
There are only a few Pullman porters still alive. But once there were thousands of them, most of them African-American men. And to be an overnight porter on one of George Pullman's railroad cars was to be an agent of change, political, cultural, economic. This fascinating social history is told in a new book, Rising from the Rails, The Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. At a recent party held at a Boston railway station, Here and Now producer April Peavy caught up with some retired Pullman porters and with author Larry Tye.
During this era, and I'm talking about the whole era from the end of the Civil War on for 100 years, it was very unusual for a black man to do several things that Pullman porters were able to do. It was very unusual for them to be able to travel the country and see anything outside of their local community. It was very unusual for them to have money in their pocket. and to have enough to earn a decent living. And the Pullman porters, over those years, observed the lessons that they learned from their wealthy white passengers, everything from financial lessons to the importance of education to a sense that America and the American experience was something that they could grab onto. And this was the ultimate all-American success story.
Gates. I was a Pullman porter. I made bed, waited on people, rich and poor. Put them to bed, wake them up. And I had a lot. I used to hold a lot of school children, a lot of 14 and 15 girls going to college at night. When the boys come up, I said, uh-oh.
At what age were you a Pullman porter?
Oh, I started when I was about 15 or 18 years old. For 52 years on it.
For 52 years.
That's my age. Yeah, I love my job, I did. I liked it. I put a lot of time in. I couldn't do it no more, though.
My name is Ellen Martin Story, and my father was a Pullman porter for about 15 years, from the late 19-teens through the 30s. My grandfather, he was a Pullman porter his whole career, and he built his own house. So for an African-American family to have a house that was built, that my father grew up in, and his brothers and sisters, back in the early 1900s, was incredible. I mean, African-American families didn't have that, but they had that. They had a car. My dad had one of the first TVs because they had been Pullman porters, and they had that steady income.
What is it like to see your dad's story now in print?
It's emotional.
Is your dad still around?
No, my dad passed away a month after Larry interviewed him. So my dad would have been so happy at this. He really would have. He would have thought, this is just the greatest thing.
They say that the civil rights movement was born in Montgomery, Alabama, with the Montgomery bus boycott. The first person that Rosa Parks talked to after she was arrested, and the guy who came and bailed her out, was Edgar Nixon, a Pullman porter. He was the brains behind the Montgomery bus boycott, only he was too busy traveling the country by train to run the boycott himself. So excuse my expression, but he took this young, naive minister named Martin Luther King Jr., who happened to have the biggest church in town, and he decided this will be the front guy who will get this boycott going. But behind the scenes, it was a Pullman porter who was pulling the strings. Malcolm X was a railroad porter. He wasn't with the Pullman Company, but he was part of that same generation. And Malcolm X said that he learned how human relations worked more by watching what went on in the closed capsule of the railroad car than in anything he ever learned later in the civil rights movement. And he was quite extraordinary in translating his experiences from the railroad car into his experiences with America. If you look at prominent African Americans today, be they in law and science, in politics, or in any field that you can name, there's an extraordinary and a disproportionate percent of them who are the children and grandchildren, the nieces and nephews of Pullman porters and of dining car guys like George Johnson.
My name is George E. Johnson, and I was a dining car waiter and a waiter in charge who's similar to a head waiter in a restaurant or a hotel.
When were you on the trains, working on the trains?
I went to work for them in 1940 and retired in 1971.
What did your job entail?
Well, we had dining cars in those days, full dining cars, and people came in from various parts of the train to come in to eat. It was my job at that time. When I first went on, I had all I was doing was serving, because we had a porter, a steward. The stewards were all white, and the rest of the help was all black at that time. And I served people. And, of course, the more money you made depended upon your service and your affability. That's where you made your money.
What I'm trying to do in this book is say, behind that experience of that incredible service in their being very obliging, they were wearing a mask, and they had to endure extraordinary humiliation. And it's the kind of experience that porters very seldom talked about. And I'm trying to say, yes, there was an era of romance. But when we look beyond the romance, the real romance of their stories is that they survived and they went on to produce so many people who are making contributions to America, and we ought to understand what they went through in doing that.
Historian Larry Tye's new book is called Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. Our piece was produced by Here and Now's April Peavy.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email. Our address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
And don't forget to tell us the town you're from and how to pronounce your name.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Zhang Yanyang exposed the Chinese government cover-up of the SARS epidemic. Now the elderly doctor is undergoing indoctrination classes. We'll have a report from Beijing. I'm Alan Cockle.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
It's Here and Now.
There's a quiet little war underway in some school districts around the country over a bill that is passed in the U.S. House of Representatives but stalled in the Senate. It's called the Child Medication Safety Act. The bill's main provision? That teachers cannot force parents to medicate their children for conditions like attention deficit disorder or depression. As many as 11 million American schoolchildren took prescription drugs for mental health in 2002, and the number is rising. Are we dealing with an epidemic of mental disorders, or are schools contributing to the misdiagnosis and over-medication of kids? Sheila Matthews is a parent and co-founder of Parents for Label and Drug-Free Education. She joins us from New Canaan, Connecticut. Welcome, Sheila.
Thank you for having Able Child on today.
Sheila, you have a son who was misdiagnosed with attention deficit disorder. Tell us the story.
Basically, my son was having some issues in the classroom, and I wanted some educational testing done. And during the process, I was handed very selective research on attention deficit disorder and pamphlets on drugs.
Do you feel that you were pressured to give your son drugs?
Yeah, I feel that I was misled into what the diagnosis was, and I was pressured to, I did feel pressured to put my son on these drugs.
If you had not done that, what was the school telling you would happen?
They were basically telling me they had nothing else to offer him, that that there were no programs for him, that there was really nothing else I could do but put my son on these drugs.
So if you want an education, you need to take the pill.
That's basically how I felt.
And what do you do on the other side with parents who are unreasonable, who just don't want to listen to any advice that medication really is the answer for their child, and that child is distracting the classroom, preventing learning for everyone, or worse, has a potential for violence in our schools?
Well, I don't think drugs are the answer, and as a parent that's defying the diagnosis has every right to do that, and you know, the fact is children are actually dying from these drugs. We have our board members who have suffered losses. Their children are no longer with us. They're dead from either toxic levels of the drugs or withdrawal, which now the FDA has put out a warning that these antidepressants are linked to suicide. So, you know, do you think the answer is to medicate these children to death to keep them in the seats?
How many are we talking about there?
Well, we have 197 reported deaths to the FDA just alone on Ritalin. So we have hundreds of children dead.
Now, but the teachers do spend their whole day with our children, and there are school psychologists available to monitor how the children are doing in the classroom. Don't you want teachers to be sort of your first line of defense in telling you, alerting you to trouble that might be going on?
Absolutely, but I don't think that it's the teacher's job or the teacher's own desire to be mental health clinicians. I think their jobs are to be teachers. And so I don't feel that there's a place for coercing parents or giving them misleading information. They should be educating our children, not medicating them.
Sheila, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sheila Matthews is co-founder of Parents for Label and Drug-Free Education. We turn now to Peter Welly. He's a school psychologist and a spokesman for the National Association of School Psychologists. He joins us from Moultonboro, New Hampshire. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm well. This bill would stop a teacher from essentially telling parents, medicate your child or they can't come to this school. What's your objection to that?
Well, the opposition to the legislation is basically twofold. First, on the face of it, it sounds very legitimate. However, requiring states to establish laws prohibiting schools from making recommendations seems to be unnecessary because the coercion that's implied in that is already in legislation. So the second part of that is that we also see that it would limit parents' ability to interact professionally with the school staff.
Why? What's in the bill that limits that?
Well, it's not necessarily the bill. It's the implications of how the bill would be enacted. If we look at other states that have had this legislation, we might see that the interpretation by local school districts or educational agencies tend to then make a gag rule that ostensibly then doesn't allow teachers or school psychologists or nurses to speak candidly with parents about their options.
Okay, so that is not in the federal bill, but that might be the reaction to it and how it's interpreted.
And it has been in states that have enacted this legislation. I think there are 9 states currently. Connecticut has just rescinded their legislation.
What do you say to parents who say the potential for misdiagnosis in some of these cases is enormous and that they don't want the schools getting too involved in this and ending up with their children on drugs that might be harmful?
Well, I think that there are 2 points to that. Is one misdiagnosis, and the other is that the conversation between schools and schools personnel is very separate than parents and their medical staff and the people that they seek medical treatment from. I think schools need to be able to tell parents what they're seeing in schools. And then if this is a condition that's, say, an anxiety disorder or another mental illness, then refer them to their physician or their health care providers outside of school.
What about the case of a harried teacher with a crowded classroom who just wants a disruptive child on medication to make life easier? I mean, it has happened. It does happen.
Well, I think the issue there is that if you're requiring a parent to put a child on medication for their access to school, that's not only wrong, that's illegal. So that there are already mechanisms in place to deal with those. If you're talking about a harried teacher, then you're talking about more of a support system for a child within that particular class. And those are things that schools need to be set up to address.
What do you say to parents who say this should be left up to doctors? that they're most qualified to make this call?
I think doctors are definitely important in the prescription because schools do not prescribe medications. But and the other part of that is that doctors working without the observation of all the people that are involved in the child's life, of which school personnel are some, is going to be a diagnosis that's somewhat in the dark.
And what do you say to parents who are worried about side effects with some of these drugs, including deaths of children on some of them?
I think the side effects of any medication are important, and that's why it's also very important to be collaborative with school personnel who can observe children whether they are or not on medication, but have a collaborative approach with the parents and their health care providers to make sure that they have all the information about a child's behavior. Because oftentimes, if you look at asthma medication, if you look at other kinds of medication, when we have children in school, we have a relationship with the prescribing physician or the prescribing health care provider so that we can communicate directly to them about the child's behavior and the child's symptoms.
Thank you, Peter.
You're very welcome.
Peter Welly is a spokesman for the National Association of School Psychologists.
Coming up, novels about novelists, Henry James and Edgar Allan Poe. You're listening to Here and Now. At least 7 children have been killed nationwide in the past 3 months, strangled or asphyxiated by automobile power windows. It's a surprising number, though one study suggests that over the past 20 years, several dozen children and teenagers have died this way. The federal agency responsible for car safety says it will propose new power window safety rules in about a month. That's something that Jeanette Fennell has been calling for a long time. She's the founder of the advocacy group Kids and Cars. Welcome, Jeanette.
Thank you.
Well, how does this happen? Do these deaths follow a particular pattern?
They certainly do. What we find is happening is young children will be in a vehicle, and let's say they put the window down, and they want to wave to someone or say hi. And that movement for them to kind of get off the seat causes their knee or their foot to lay upon the rocker or toggle switch, and totally unbeknownst to them, the window rises, and it takes them by their neck with the window, and they're strangled or asphyxiated, or their trachea can be broken.
Now, 9 out of 10 new cars have power windows nowadays, but I understand that U.S.-made cars are a bigger problem than European or Japanese designs. Why is that?
Well, it's interesting because the power window switches in most vehicles, except for the Detroit-based automakers, Ford, GM, and Daimler Chrysler, they have a safer type of switch, which we call the pull-up push-down switch, and that's where you have to kind of put your finger underneath the switch to pull it up. The Detroit-based automakers still are installing a rocker or toggle type of switch, and it's very easy to inadvertently actuate that switch, and that's why these children are dying that way.
You've been trying to get automakers to solve this problem for a long time. Tell us about that.
They have been sitting on a petition that asked for action on this since 1996. All the children that have died this year, those 7 little lives, none of those children were even born in 1996. This should have been taken care of years ago.
Why do you think the industry hasn't switched over to something safer?
That's the kind of the million-dollar question here. When you say the industry, yes, the industry has. I mean, the lion's share of manufacturers, except for those 3, have put in these safer type of switches. It's just, you know, defies logic. There's no common sense answer. In fact, if the industry would all go to the same type of switch, to a pull-up push-down switch on all their vehicles, they would save money.
You have sort of an interesting history here because you were the driving force behind another safety feature in cars. Can you tell us about that?
Well, unfortunately, my husband and I, with our young son, were kidnapped and locked in the trunk of our car. And the good news, of course, is that we did survive. But it was that life-changing, life-altering event that really sprung us into action.
What was the safety feature that you got introduced as a result of your ordeal?
What we were able to accomplish was to get a trunk release mandated for every vehicle that is purchased or leased in the United States. So it doesn't matter where on earth these cars are manufactured. If you have a 2002 or newer model vehicle with a trunk, there now will be a phosphorescent, easy-to-pull trunk release in your vehicle.
Are there other dangers that you think people should be aware of with kids in cars?
Well, I think people need to understand is it they should never, ever leave a child unattended in or around a vehicle.
Jeanette, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Jeanette Fennell of the group Kids in Cars spoke to us from her office in Leawood, Kansas.
There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Alan Cockle.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
It's Here and Now.
From rivals to running mates, presidential hopeful John Kerry chose fellow Senator John Edwards of North Carolina to join him on the Democratic ticket.
I have chosen a man who understands and defends the values of America. A man who has shown courage and conviction as a champion for middle-class Americans and for those struggling to reach the middle class. A man whose life has prepared him for leadership and whose character brings him to exercise it.
Praise enough to make John Edwards blush, but if he did, we didn't see it. He wasn't at Kerry's announcement in Pittsburgh today. The Democrats duo will team up this evening and begin campaigning together tomorrow.
There was a time, not so long ago, when novelists merely wrote novels. Now it seems they appear in them as characters.
Dearest, I feel certain that I'm going mad again. I feel we can't go through another of these terrible times, and I shan't recover this time. I begin to hear voices and can't concentrate. So I am doing what seems to be the best thing to do.
That's from last year's hit movie, The Hours, based on Michael Cunningham's book, in which novelist Virginia Woolf is one of the main protagonists. Today we're talking about two new books, The Master by Colm Tobin, about Henry James, and John May's Poe and Fanny, which is a reimagining of the life of Edgar Allan Poe. For more, I'm joined in the studio by Here and Now's literary correspondent, Steve Almond. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
Novels about novelists. Is this a new genre?
No, I don't think it's a new genre, but it is a growth industry in the literary world. We have seen a proliferation of these. In addition to The Master by Tobin, we are also going to be treated to a second Henry James novel called Author, Author by the fairly well-known British writer named David Lodge.
So what's the attraction, do you think? What makes a modern-day writer decide to cast a historical novelist as his or her protagonist?
Well, I think the first thing is the old saw, write what you know. And writers, the act of writing is so solitary and dogged and lonely, and you immediately will have insight into a writer's life if you're a writer. I think there's a good deal also of appreciation for and love for these particular authors. I don't think you decide to write a book about an author who you don't feel passionately about in some way. I know that in the case of Cunningham, for instance, his life was transformed by reading Virginia Woolf.
The potential problem, of course, though, is that a writer's life just doesn't necessarily have that much drama.
Yeah. As a writer, I will tell you, you are correct about that. The central drama, it's sort of the Barton Fink crisis, the central drama is man sits at typewriter, or woman, struggles with language. Ah, he's come to a solution. And, of course, for the audience, you're just watching somebody sit there with sort of imaginary thought bubbles.
Doesn't sound like the ingredients of a page-turner. How do these authors address that? Let's talk about The Master, the Henry James book.
Absolutely. Well, it is the central narrative challenge when your character is a writer. And I think they do it actually in quite different ways. Tobin writes a lot like Henry James, not surprisingly. It's very interior, it's very subtle, it's very psychological, and the part of James's life that he picks is the most tumultuous years. Now, I must say that Henry James did not have a particularly tumultuous life in the Hollywood sense. There weren't a lot of peaks and valleys. Creatively, there certainly were, but he was, like a lot of writers, marked by his standing back and observing posture in life. He was not a guy who was, you know, at the center of the spotlight. So Tobin does a good job in choosing the 5 years of his life that are really sort of the most tumultuous. And I'm going to read a passage that deals with, I think, what is the central struggle in the book, aside from James wanting to write and be famous, which is his dealing with his sexuality.
Yeah, go ahead.
So let me read, actually, he's The situations that he is having to sleep next to his friend Oliver Wendell Holmes, which of course—
later the Supreme Court justice.
Yes, absolutely. And more importantly for a young closeted Henry James, a hottie. So I'll just read a little scene here. They're having to sleep together. "Good night," Holmes replied. Holmes did not turn but lay flat on his back. Remember, they're both naked. To make sure that he did not fall out of bed, Henry had to move closer to him, but then moved away, keeping near the edge, yet still touching Holmes, who lay impassive. He wondered if he would ever again be so intensely alive. Every breath, every hint that Holmes might move, or even the idea that Holmes, too, was awake, burned in his mind. There was no possibility of sleeping. Holmes, he thought, must have his arms folded on his chest, and there was no sound from him. His very immobility suggested that he was lying awake and alert. Henry longed to know if Holmes were as conscious as he was of their bodies touching, or if he lay there casually, unaware of the mass of coiled heat which lay up against him.
Tobin's obviously imagined that, but James's life is documented in great detail. Do we know how much history there is in this historical fiction?
Well, we do know that they were good friends. We do know one of the central sort of the frontispiece of the novel is the failure of James's play Guy d'Homville, which was a terrible disaster in British theater. And so we get an excruciating scene to open the novel of him facing the jeers of the audience. These are episodes that we know happened. I think that what is imagined, and I think quite effectively imagined by Tobin, is the interior life of Henry James, battling to engage with the world, also to observe it, and certainly battling with his own sexual impulses.
What about Poe and Fanny, John May's book about Edgar Allan Poe? How does that hew to history?
Well, there are more departures in Poe and Fanny. And
more unknown things about Poe's life, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's based more on a conjecture. That is that Edgar Allan Poe certainly conducted an affair with Frances Osgood, who was a poet who's no longer remembered but was quite famous in her time. This is 1845 in New York City, and might have fathered her child. There's paternity in question. Mostly what we hear about Edgar Allan Poe is that he was married to this scandalously young cousin of his, but this actually explores the possibility of, and to some extent the reality of, his passionate literary and romantic relationship with Frances Osgood. It takes a lot more liberties, and I have to say it's a terrific book. The way it solves this problem of how do you write about a writer sitting at a keyboard is it writes about the entire milieu of 1845 pre-Civil War New York literary society, when in fact the literary landscape of America was just taking shape, and you had these incredible literary feuds erupting and all these broadsheets, tons of magazines and newspapers that all featured poems. Poe himself was a kind of rock star after The Raven came out.
After The Raven, yeah. You liked this book. You found the characters believable? They lived for you as like real people?
Absolutely, and I should say that it's not just Edgar Allan Poe or Frances Osgood. He also captures an editor named N.P. Willis, quite successful in his time. He uses other characters, in other words, to give us a sort of more nuanced view of Poe himself, who was an alcoholic, quite troubled. His wife was ill. He never enjoyed the literary success he wanted to. And he's not the sort of guy we can imagine like Henry James, who was as ruminative.
Still, Steve, I wonder about this. You're an author of a recent, well-received book. How would you feel if we all sat around reading books about Steve Almond instead of by Steve Almond?
I think you would feel very bored, is how you would feel. There is something of a kind of auto-cannibalism in this, but I have to say that a good character is a good character. Whatever struggles they're encountering, the whole trick in good fiction is to get inside the mind and heart of the characters. I want to read a little passage from Poe and Fanny just to give you a sense of the sort of slap and tickle relationship between Frances Osgood and Poe. She's called Fanny in the book. Fanny stared at him, wearing a sad smile. What little she knew, that he had been an orphan, that his stories revealed an obsession with death, that he struggled against poverty, that his wife was ill, all moved and fascinated her. And now he had written a poem so remarkable that half of America could quote portions of it. He sat before her proud and straight, excessively polite, asking nothing for all his misfortune. "You must be a very special man," she said, overcome with a feeling of compassion for him just then, "and you must think me very frivolous." Her words alarmed him. Embarrassed, he started to speak, but Fanny stopped him. "I want to be your friend." She swallowed and searched for words. "Your writing is astonishing, and you will find many people willing to help if you let them." He pursed his lips and looked away, and Fanny decided she was saying all the wrong things. I love that. It's so awkward. It's the early stages. It's a literary courtship that is actually woman to man in this case. And as that relationship deepens, they share not just, obviously, a romantic attraction, but a great sense of themselves as writers and what literature can mean in the world.
Steve Almond, our regular literary critic, reading from and talking about Poe and Fanny by John May, about Edgar Allan Poe. The other book we talked about was The Master by Colm Tobin, about Henry James. For more on these, visit our website, here-now.org. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Alan Cockle.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.